Differential forms are special tensors. They are covariant and they are totally anti-symmetric. What's special about them that we should pay so much attention to these covariant, totally anti-symmetric tensors, these differential forms? Now, what's special about them is that they define integration. They are the right thing that can be integrated. They're the only thing that can be integrated, in fact. And the reason is that they are anti-symmetric and covariant, exactly that, because that gives them the right transformation properties that integrals need to have. And that has to do with the fact that multidimensional integration under a change of variables produces a Jacobian. Now, this generalizes to the fact that when we have an integral over a multidimensional manifold and we change chart, then we get also, in effect, a Jacobian if we look at it in a chart. We get something totally anti-symmetric that transforms in a covariant way. Now, before we can integrate differential forms, we need to consider the concept of orientation. And it's a fairly simple concept that can be illustrated already in the example of a one-dimensional manifold. So imagine that our manifold M is just one-dimensional, so I'm drawing it in this simple way here. Then I could have two kinds of charts. For example, this would be a chart. You see, a chart is a map from the manifold to Rn. In this case, the manifold is one-dimensional, so the chart goes to R. So here's our manifold. One-dimensional manifold, and a chart maps every point on the manifold into a point of R. And it could, for example, map this end of the manifold, that point P, into this point alpha of P, if alpha is the name of the chart. So this point is mapped into this, some point in the middle is mapped into some point in the middle of that interval, and then the final point here is mapped into the final point there. However, in principle, there's no reason to do it this way around. There's no reason why the point P gets mapped into the left end of the interval and Q into the right end. We could also find a chart that works the other way around, where the point P is not mapped into the left end of the interval, but to the right end of the interval. Points in the middle are mapped into points in the middle of the interval, and then the end point is mapped to the leftmost point. So these two types of charts, the alpha chart and the beta chart, differ by an orientation. But this matters, because if we want to define, as we do, if we want to define integration on manifolds in terms of integration over Rn in a chart, then since there are these two charts, and since integrating an interval from left to right or from right to left makes a difference by a minus sign, we have to keep track of these minus signs. So we have to decide how we want to integrate. Do we want to use this chart, or do we want to use that chart? The result will be the same in magnitude, but they will differ by a sign. Now, for higher dimensional manifolds, oh, look at this, now I drew on it. So I removed that scratch. All right. So now we are working with n-dimensional manifolds. And there may not exist a single chart that covers all of the manifold. In general, we may need a patchwork of multiple charts to cover the manifold. In this case, we say, this is a definition, that a complete collection of charts, that is to say an atlas, is called oriented if among all overlapping charts, let's say one chart maps into coordinates x and the other one maps into Rn with coordinates that are called x tilde, then the Jacobi determinants are positive. So if all chart changes have positive Jacobian, then we say that our atlas is oriented. And a manifold is called orientable if it possesses an oriented chart. you see, we need to keep in mind that the same manifold may have different orientations assigned to it. Or a manifold may not even have an orientation. It may not be possible to give it orientation, for example, for the Möbius strip. Now, a manifold together with a choice of oriented atlas is called an oriented manifold. All of this is a lot of words just to express that we need to choose a sign. Then once we have an atlas, which is to say a collection of charts, a collection of coordinate systems which together cover the entire manifold, such that all of the Jacobians of the coordinate changes are positive, then if you consider now a fresh chart, you can consider its Jacobian with the charts of our atlas, and this Jacobian might be positive or negative, and correspondingly, we will say that this chart is positive or negative relative to that atlas, relative to that definition of orientation on the manifold. Today, when we integrate, we will need eventually the concept of a volume form. Some integrals we can do without, some integrals we can only do with a volume form. But let's introduce it already because it has a relation to these orientations. First of all, what is a volume form? Let's consider an N form, omega. And it is called a volume form if it nowhere vanishes. A volume form is used for a particular purpose. It tells us for every piece of the manifold how much volume we should think it has. So let's say we take a little bit of let's say we choose a coordinate system, and then we choose a small range of the coordinates around some point. So we dedicate, we choose a point on the manifold, and then we look at the little region around it, a finite size region. And we define the region by letting the coordinates run a little bit. And then we can ask, how much volume is this? Now, before we define a volume form, there is no way of telling how much volume that would be. And the reason is that the same coordinate range, let's say in the x1 direction, from 3 to 3.1 on the right side and down to 2.9 on the left side, one might think, okay, that's a range of 0.2, from 2.9 to 3.1. And one might think, okay, that's a small volume. But you could change coordinates. So that the same endpoints of that interval would be millions apart. So therefore, before we introduce the notion of volume form, we cannot really assign a volume to anything on our manifolds. These manifolds are neither big nor small. They neither have a lot of volume nor little volume, because all we have so far is just charts. And what looks like a big distance in one chart can be a tiny distance in another chart. In order to actually assign a volume to any range of coordinate values, we have to have something that is defined independently of any charts, that expresses the notion of a volume coordinate independently. That's the role of a volume form. And since we do not want that a region of our manifold that has a finite extent, has no volume, we want that the volume form never vanishes. So the volume density should always be finite all over the manifold. And it turns out, one can prove, that if a manifold possesses a volume form, then it is also orientable and vice versa. So now, we are ready to define integration. We will come back to the volume forms later. For that, Let us look at what we know about integration from calculus 3 or calculus 4. What we know from about integration from calculating over Rn. Let's say we integrate over Rn, a function over Rn, and we change variables in the integration region. So let's say we have a function, and this is now calculus, not differential geometry. We have a function g over Rn. We want to integrate that function over all of Rn. Then that is a number. We can evaluate that same integral to obtain the same number using a different set of variables, different coordinates in Rn. Right? So we can choose different variables. And from calculus, we know that if we change variables, then in order to obtain the same number, we need to integrate g of x tilde, because what used to be x is now a function of the new variables x tilde. And then we cannot just integrate over the new variables x tildes over all of Rn. No, there is this factor here that takes care of the fact that a delta x1 and a delta x2 could be quite different in size from a delta x tilde 1 and a delta x tilde 2. And in order to take into account that squishing and stretching of intervals, we need this determinant, this Jacobi determinant here. Now, we want to develop a formula like that, but we want to integrate differential forms over a differentiable manifold. And we would like to be able to do that concretely. So we take our differential form that's defined on a differentiable manifold, and we map both of them into Rn with the techniques that we have. So we know how to represent a differential form in a chart, and also how to map a differentiable manifold using a chart into Rn. So we want to express these integrals of differential forms over manifolds and parts of manifolds in terms of integrals like this. But then they must respect that. They must have this behavior here. So therefore now, for a general n-dimensional differentiable manifolds, which may or may not be Rn, but we can think of it as not being Rn, we consider an n form in some chart. So if omega is some n form in an n-dimensional differentiable manifold, then we can always, in a chart, represent it by saying that this is a zero form, a function, times the wedge product of all these basis vectors. Remember, the reason for why an n form in on an n-dimensional manifold can always be written in this way is that the space of differential n forms at every point is only one dimensional. There's only one basis vector, and that's this one. You can't, for example, have dx1 wedge dx1, because that would be zero, right? So the space of differential n forms is one dimensional at every point. So every n form field can be written in this way. So let's say we have one of those, and we want to integrate it over our n-dimensional manifold. This is the beginning of a general pattern. An n form can be integrated over an n-dimensional manifold. An s form can be integrated over an s-dimensional manifold. So the lower the degree of the differential form, the lower the dimension of the manifold that it can be integrated over. So for example, a ball is three-dimensional. You can integrate a three form over a ball. But the sphere, the surface of it, is two-dimensional. So you can integrate only a two form over the sphere. And if you have a half sphere, then it has a one-dimensional boundary, which is the equator. And you can integrate a one form over the equator, because the equator is only one-dimensional. OK, but here we are dealing with an n-dimensional manifold, and we have an n form. So if omega, our n form, is represented in one chart in this way, then we can ask, well, what is the representation of omega in a different chart? Let's say a chart that has coordinates x tilde. Well, omega, the same differential form, is then written as f of x tilde. Remember, that's a zero form. That's just a function. So therefore, there's nothing happening to this itself. We just evaluate it at the same point, but we have to take into account that the points are mapped into each other. And then we have all of these Jacobian matrices here, because these are basis vectors of the quotient space, and we know from the physicist's definition how they transform under change of chart. These are a lot of terms, right? Because you have here d by dx1 by dx tilde xi1, etc. We are summing over all repeated indices, so all of those x tilde indices are summed over. But remember that each of these expressions is totally anti-symmetric, which means that all of these things that occur here, since this is an n form, so the top form, there is only one expression like that. Everything else is the same up to minus sign. You see, it's always dx tilde 1, veg dx tilde 2, veg dx tilde 3. Each one of the indices occurs exactly once. You can reorder them, but that just gives you a minus sign for the odd number of permutations and the plus sign for the even number of permutations. So therefore, all of this can be reordered. All of these terms can be rewritten in the form where you have dx tilde 1, veg dx tilde 2, veg dx tilde 3, just like we had it here. So we get a lot of terms, and we get them with plus ones and minus ones, depending on whether this is an odd or an even permutation of this, which means that the differential n form in the new coordinate system takes the following form. This is just carried forward. And then summing all of this for all permutations, keeping track of minus signs, just produces a sum here with plus and minus signs such that this is the determinant of the Jacobian. And you see, this only works that we get this determinant with dx by dx tilde because these guys are covariant, not contravariant. If these were contravariant ones, we would get the tildes up here and the untilded in the denominator. And they have to be totally anti-symmetric in order for this to arrange itself to become the determinant. But this is the factor that we are looking for, because from calculus we know that this is the factor that needs to appear as we change coordinates. So therefore, we can't just work with tensors. Regular tensors wouldn't behave this way. But as it happens, differential n forms are working exactly this way, that they produce this determinant factor that we know ought to occur when we integrate and change coordinates. So comparing these, we see that this exactly matches under change of coordinates. So therefore, the following definition of the integral of n forms over an n-dimensional differential manifold is chart independent. That is to say, is well defined. And here is the definition. Let's assume that M is an oriented n-dimensional manifold, and that omega is some n form. And in a chart alpha, it is written in this way, some scalar function here, and then here the veg product of the dxi's. Then we define the integral over this differential n form of this differential n form over the manifold to be equal to, and here, I mean, this is all abstract differential n form on the abstract manifold M. Here, everything is in Rn. It's all reduced here to something that we know how to do from calculus. So this is the integral defined as it is defined in calculus. See, there are no wedges here. This is just the ordinary way that you would write an integral, where this function f of x is being integrated over that volume here in Rn, where alpha of m is the image of that manifold. You see, this manifold could have an image which in Rn, for example, is some sort of ellipsoid or a sphere or whatever it might be. Of course, there are differentiable manifolds that you can't cover with a single chart. In that case, you will have to piece things together. You divide this manifold M into pieces that have charts, and then for each chart you write that down and you add things up. And the fact that we have an oriented atlas here, that we have an oriented manifold, means that the piecing together of the pieces is well defined. Because in the overlaps, so if we pieced it together differently, we would still get the same value out of it because we don't suddenly get extra minus signs from a change of chart. Right, so now we know how to integrate differential n forms over an n-dimensional manifold. Now let's introduce the boundary operator. I mentioned it earlier, but now is the time to introduce it properly. You see, where we are heading is we will today, after we've defined integration, we will find some of the most beautiful formulas of mathematics that have to do with integration. You know, a lot of people say that their most beautiful formula is Euler's, EI pi is minus 1. I show you a competitor to this. Just as pretty as this one, maybe better. In some sense, deeper. OK, for that, we need the boundary operator. So imagine, assume that G is some region in the manifold. So for example, I mean, simplest case, manifold might be R3, and G is a ball. So let's say it's an n-dimensional open and connected subset of the n-dimensional manifold M. As I said, for example, the manifold M might be R3, and then G is a three-dimensional ball in it. Its surface would be the sphere. Then we denote the n minus one dimensional boundary manifold of that G, let's say a ball, by del G, the sphere. Okay, so we write del G is the boundary of G. So G is a ball, boundary of it is a sphere, del G is a sphere. And then we introduce the notion of smoothness of that boundary. We say that that boundary manifold, which is n minus 1 dimensional, is smooth if everywhere there is some, if it can be covered by regions such that for each of these regions there is a chart which maps it into Rn minus 1 in this way. So you have that we say that delta G is smooth if locally there exist charts such that if you take the big manifold such as Rn and you look at the ball G and then its boundary, which might be which would be the sphere, then every piece of the sphere can be mapped through a chart into a piece of Rn minus 1 inside Rn. And so it should be a plane here. It should be an n minus 1 dimensional plane in this n dimensional Rn. So basically, what we're excluding here is things like that, boundaries like that.
You said G needs to be an open and connected subset.
Mm-hmm.
Does the boundary then belong to?
No, it wouldn't in this case. If it's open, it doesn't. That's right.
And so like in the case of a ball, if it was a ball of radius 1, it's a ball of radius 1 without.
Without the sphere, that's right. Yes. So it's the set of the limit points. OK. Now, there are some propositions that we won't prove, but they're sort of intuitive. If M is an orientable manifold, then a G, the region in it, like if R3 is suddenly orientable, and then you take a ball in it, clearly that's orientable as well, because it inherits that, right? So orientability means that you have a set of charts that cover the whole thing such that any chart change has a positive Jacobian. That's, of course, inherited to a subset as well. And then, and that's a slightly more non-trivial, the orientation of G also induces an orientation of its boundary, right? That's inherited as well. So now we finally have all the ingredients for one of the most important and beautiful theorems in mathematics, and that's Stokes' theorem. It turns out that Stokes' theorem is the mother of integration theorems. Virtually all of the integration theorems are Stokes' theorem in one form or the other, as we will see today. So Stokes' theorem says the following. If the closure G bar of G, so now you're taking into account the surface itself as well, is a compact n-dimensional region, then this is true. What does it say, actually? It says that if you have a differential n minus 1 form, let's say, if you have a differential n minus 1 form, omega is in lambda n minus 1, and you integrate it over the boundary, which is n minus 1 dimensional, of an n-dimensional region G, then that's the same as if you integrate it over the entire region, the exterior derivative of that differential n minus 1 form. So for example, let's say G is a ball in R3. Then del G is the sphere around it. Then let's say omega is a 2 form. So the 2 form can be integrated over this two-dimensional boundary sphere. So what this is saying, what the theorem is saying, is that integrating the 2 form over the two-dimensional sphere, that is the boundary of the ball, is the same as integrating the 3 form that you get by taking the 2 form and taking the exterior derivative of it, integrating the 3 form over the entire ball, that is to say the volume inside of it, the actual, the bulk of it, and that's the boundary here. So integrating the derivative, in some sense, it's a derivation, the d, integrating the derivative over the full dimensional thing is the same as not integrating that over the boundary. I mean, not taking the derivative, integrating it over the boundary. And you see, this formula has a beautiful symmetry here, which is that if you view the del, the boundary operator, as a kind of derivative, and it is a kind of derivative if you think about it. Because what does it do? It takes a shape, let's say a potato shape, right? It takes a potato, and then it literally tells you the shape of it, how it changes. It tells you, in a way, how the rate of volume changes as you change the boundary, right? It tells you what the boundary is. It tells you how it bulges, right? So the boundary is kind of, you know, imagine you're integrating a function f of x, right? Then let's say this is the area here. That's the integral. And then the function is the derivative of the integral, right? It tells you at what rate things are changing. So you can view the co-boundary operator, you can view the boundary operator as doing something that is akin to differentiating, but completely geometric. It just tells you what's the leading edge of a bulk, just like this here, right? So if this is f of x, that's the volume in here, right? The area in here, then df by dx is f of x. It's that height here, right? By the fundamental theorem of calculus. You differentiate the area, you get the height of the function. And so what this is saying is that indeed you can view the derivative operator, the boundary operator exactly. I mean, I was just hand-wavingly saying these things there, that taking the boundary of something is like taking the derivative. And this is saying that it's not just hand-waving, it's exactly like that. Because what it says is that if you integrate over the boundary, you can either differentiate the boundary or differentiate the function. That's what it essentially says, right? You can either differentiate here, put the d here, or you put the d there, right? This is differentiating the function. This is differentiating the geometry. And that's the same. Now, let's see how this actually pans out for this exactly. Because if I'm right, then the fundamental theorem of calculus better be a special case of this, right? In fact, it turns out that if you want to look up a proof of this theorem, you will see that what they do is they write everything in coordinates and then look at every dimension separately and then reduce it for every dimension to the fundamental theorem of calculus. It is really the fundamental theorem of calculus, but lifted to manifolds and differential forms. Okay, so after all of that hand waving, let's see how this pans out actually in the simplest case in one dimension. Oh, actually, before that, I wanted to show you what happens if we iterate it. So here we have that if you differentiate the differential form and integrate that, you might as well not differentiate the differential form, but differentiate the shape by taking its boundary, right? What if we iterate that, if we keep going to the second derivative, third derivative, and boundary of boundary, and so on? So let us try iterating Stokes. So let's assume that G is itself the boundary of something, right? So if G is itself the boundary of something, so then the G, so here we have it, right? So here we have our Stokes theorem. And then we say, well, what if G is itself the boundary of something? Then we can write the G here as the del of H. And we can therefore write the del of G as the del of H, right? If G was the boundary of H. But we can also apply Stokes' theorem now in this direction. We can say, instead of differentiating here, taking the boundary, I might as well put the differentiation there, because that's what Stokes' theorem says. If you have a boundary operator here, you can turn that into a derivative operator there. So then you obtain this. And what you find is a triviality. You find that the left-hand side is 0, the right-hand side is 0. But interestingly, for completely different reasons. On the right-hand side, you have that this integral over a differential n minus 1 form over the boundary of H is 0. Why? Well, because the boundary of a boundary is always vanishing, right? So no matter what that differential form is, the boundary of boundary is always no point. Like if you remember, if you take, for example, a half sphere, then its boundary is the equator. But the equator doesn't have a boundary. Or you take a ball. Its boundary is the sphere. But the sphere doesn't have a boundary. And that's a general feature geometrically, that boundaries don't have boundaries. So that's why that is vanishing, for geometric reasons. But here we have also that this is vanishing independently of what h might be, because d applied to d is always 0. D squared is always 0. And that's purely because of algebraic reasons. It's because you anti-symmetrize twice, but the second derivatives are d by dxi, d by dxj. That's symmetric. D by dxi, d by dxj is the same as d by dxj, d by dxi. And that's symmetry. Means that if you then do twice the anti-symmetrization as you do with the exterior derivative, you get a 0 for completely algebraic reasons. So you get 0, 0, and so on. And so it's again showing us that taking the boundary of a region is the same as differentiating. So something completely geometric can be the same as something completely analytic and algebraic. OK, but I promised you that this can be demystified by looking at it in one dimension. simplest case. It ought to be the fundamental theorem of calculus, and it is. So one dimension here. Let's say G is one dimensional. Then what? Let's say M, our manifold, is R, one dimension only. And G is some subset, some region in it, which means it's some interval from A to B. Okay? And now we've defined G. It's some interval in R. Then what's the boundary of G? Well, that's the boundary points of that interval. They are A and B. Then we can write down what that theorem is. That theorem says that the exterior derivative of F, which needs to be a function, the exterior derivative of F integrated from A to B, so over G, over that interval, is equal to non-differentiated omega here, integrated from, well, over the boundary, right? But the boundary is the points A and B. Right? So this is a one-dimensional integration region. And that's a one form, because f is a function. Df is, therefore, a one form. So we're integrating a one form over a one-dimensional integral. And here we have a zero form integrated over a zero-dimensional manifold, which consists of just two points. So what the Stokes theorem tells us in this simple case of an interval in R is that integrating the differential of a function over an interval from A to B is the same as evaluating the function between those two points. So it's f of b minus f of a. And you may wonder, OK, so we are integrating a differential one form here. What exactly does that mean? Well, remember, a differential one form can be written in the basis as df by dx dx if it's one dimensional, right? So that's the usual. It's the derivative of f integrated over x. So integrating the derivative over an interval is the same as evaluating the function at the boundaries. And as I said, this can be generally proven by boiling it always down to this. Just choose your coordinates wisely. You may have to chop up the region in order to make that possible and so on. So the proof is tedious, but that's what it boils down to. It's just that. But then I promised earlier that Stokes' theorem, this innocent-looking but very powerful theorem here, is describing virtually all of the integration theorems. That includes Green's theorem. It includes, in complex analysis, the residue theorem. It includes what we call Stokes' theorem in electrodynamics that has to do with curl and fluid dynamics and so on. It also includes Gauss's theorem. All of these are just special cases of that. So that's what we will do for the rest of the time today. See how to integrate all of those other things. See how these other theorems arise from Stokes' theorem. But first, before we go into this, all of these examples, are there any questions so far regarding Stokes' theorem? Okay. Good. After this first special case, which was just the fundamental theorem of calculus in one dimension, let's now look at Green's theorem, which you also may remember from physics. That's in two dimensions. So imagine our manifold is two-dimensional. It's R2. So this is just a special case, right? So the manifold is R2, and G is some region in R2. So we can visualize it as some region like this. And it has a closed boundary curve, del G. Remember that the boundary curve doesn't have a boundary, right? So the del of del G is empty. And now we consider an arbitrary n minus 1 form. N is 2. So n minus 1 form is a 1 form. Let's consider an arbitrary 1 form omega so that we can apply Stokes' theorem. So now it's this situation here. G is two-dimensional, and omega is a one form, so that its exterior derivative is a two form. So we have a two form that we integrate over a two-dimensional manifold. And here we have this one form omega that we integrate over the one-dimensional boundary. So one form integrate over one-dimensional boundary. two-form integrated to be integrated over a two-dimensional region. And let's see how that plays out in the case where the manifold is R2 and G is a region in R2. We take an arbitrary one-form omega. Now remember that a one-form can always be written in terms of these basis vectors, right? So dx1 is a basis vector, dx2 is a basis vector. There are only those two because our manifold is two-dimensional. So therefore, every one-form can be written in this way. Some coefficient, some scalar coefficient function times this basis vector plus some scalar coefficient function times that basis vector. Then we need the two-form as well that we obtained by taking the exterior derivative of it. So let's just do this as a little exercise. In order to calculate the exterior derivative of that one form, we use the Leibniz rule. We use the product rule. So we apply the exterior derivative onto this. And let's start with that. If we apply the exterior derivative to this, what do we get? We get two terms. We get the exterior derivative applied to omega 1, leaving the dx1 the same. And we get a term where we leave that the same and apply the exterior derivative to dx1. Now that term is going to vanish, because we would have d dx1, that's 0. So we're only getting a term where we have the exterior derivative applied to omega 1. And here, similarly, we get a term where the exterior derivative is applied to omega 2, leaving that the same. The exterior derivative doesn't need to be applied to dx2 because that's 0. I mean, it has to be applied, but it gives us a 0. So what we have is that the d of this term is d omega 1 veg dx1. And I have to write veg now because that's a one form. And d omega 2 veg dx2. Now let's work out what they are. What is d omega 1 of x? Well, d omega 1 of x is d omega 1 by dx1. And then this basis vector plus d omega 1 by dx2, that basis vector. And what we see here is that that's going to vanish, dx1 veg dx1. So we're just left with this term here. And we get the d omega 2 of x, which has these two terms. And again, the dx2 veg dx2 goes away. So we are left with just two terms here, namely d omega 1 by dx2, dx2 veg dx1 plus d omega 1 by dx1. And that's that should be d omega 2, dx1 veg dx2. And we can now sort these things, because this is just a negative of that. So we put a minus sign here so that we can write this as that. And we obtain that the exterior derivative of that one form is given by that anti-symmetric combination, dx1 veg dx2. Right. So now Stokes' theorem says the following. We can either integrate the one form, this thing, over the boundary. So we can either take the one form here and integrate it over the boundary, del g. Or, and we will get the same number, we can integrate the two form that we calculated here and integrate it over the bulk, integrating over the entire region G. So that, by Stokes' theorem, gives us the same result. And you may have seen it before in this form, Green's theorem. So now we know it's really just Stokes' theorem. Let me remind you how these things are evaluated. Now, this is an integral over a two-dimensional region in R2 of something that's dx1, dx2. So we know how to do that. That's just the integrand, and we do a 2D integral this way. But do you remember how that works? Where you are integrating this one form over a boundary. How do you do that? How do you integrate omega 1, which is a function of x1 and x2, times dx1 plus omega 2, which is a function of x1 and x2, a dx2? How do you integrate that over the boundary? I mean, just practically, how do you write that down as a proper 1D integral? Because it seems that we have a dx1 and a dx2, but it's supposed to be a 1D integral. Well, straightforward. What we do is we use a chart. So what we need is a chart for the boundary. So the boundary gets mapped into an interval in R. And that chart has an inverse, which is a path. So it's basically a trajectory, right? So you pick points in R, and they're being mapped into points on that boundary. So we have a trajectory, a path, right? So the chart goes one way, and the trajectory goes the other way. So the chart goes from the boundary into R, or an interval of R. And then the inverse is a path that we may call gamma, which maps an interval of R into the boundary. So we have gamma of t is x1 of t, x2 of t. Right? So we have a trajectory. X1 of t, comma x2 of t are the coordinates of a point labeled by a number t. So as t ranges from t initial to t final, we are traveling around the boundary here. And now we can use the dxi is dxi, or dx1, for example, is dx1 is equal to dx1 by dt dt. Right? So we can write the dx1 as dx1 by dt times dt. And the dx2 we can write as dx2 by dt dt. And so we just end up with an integrand, which is a function of the of t times dt, and then integrate that over the t over the t interval. But you've probably seen all of that before when you did the Green's theorem, I hope. Okay, now Green's theorem is also important because it is related to complex analysis. Assume that omega is a one form in our case, just like as we had it before, but assume that it is closed. Let me just move it like this so that you can see the earlier things. Right, so what we have here is, remember, the Green's theorem, we wrote it down for an arbitrary one form, right? Arbitrary one forms can always be written in this form, a linear combination of the basis vectors in the cotangent space. But some one forms are special because they're closed, right? Which means that the exterior derivative of this thing is vanishing, right? Which means that, I wish I could move that screen here, which means that this thing is vanishing, right? That's the exterior derivative of this one form. This thing might be vanishing, which means that you have this formula. Now, if you've done complex analysis, you may remember the Cauchy-Riemann equations, which look like that. That's one of the Cauchy-Riemann equations if you interpret R2 as real axis and imaginary axis. So what we have is that the special case of Green's theorem is this. Assume that your differential one form in Green's theorem is closed, which means that the exterior derivative of it is vanishing, which means that this equation is holding for these coordinate functions that define the differential one form. Then Green's theorem tells us that because the d of omega is vanishing, we have, let me show you here, here's Green's theorem. You see, if d of omega is vanishing, if it's a closed, if omega is a closed form, then the left-hand side is vanishing, so the right-hand side must be vanishing. So that means that whenever you have a closed form and you integrate it over a boundary, it's zero. So this means, in the case of Green's theorem, that if you have a closed form, just a sec, I have to go one further down. Right. So this means that if you have a closed form, then integrating it over the boundary here always gives you zero. And that translates into the residue theorem of complex analysis, which says that if a function from a region in the complex plane, into the complex plane, is holomorphic, which is to say that it obeys the Cauchy-Riemann equations, then everywhere in that region, then you have that integrating it over the boundary is vanishing. Now, I can't show you the full matching between those two things yet, because we need some extra concept for that, because this is just one of two Cauchy-Riemann equations. The full story is that the Cauchy-Riemann equations mean that the differential form is not only closed, it also has to be what is called co-closed, and we will define co-closedness later. But we won't get to that today. It takes a bit more machinery to do that. Now, special case three. And I leave filling in the details for that to you as an exercise if you want to do it. Special case of the Stokes theorem number three. After the fundamental theorem of calculus in R, and after Green's theorem and complex integration, the residue theorem as number two, number three is this. And that's a representation of the Stokes theorem as it is often presented in electrodynamics, for example, where we deal with the gradient and also the so-called curl of a vector field. It also comes up in fluid dynamics. So imagine that the manifold that we're dealing with is R3 and regions in R3. Then the Stokes theorem, the so-called Stokes theorem in this case, which because it's a special case, not the fully general case that we have here, is often presented in this way, where we would say that if W is a vector field, we can integrate the vector field over a boundary of some region, some surface. So this is a one-dimensional boundary of a two-dimensional surface, let's say. And then we integrate this vector field along that boundary. Now, this is about, for example, an electric field that goes through a wire, a loop in a wire, or magnetic fields. Then what that Stokes theorem says is that you can calculate the same thing by taking an area that has this loop as a boundary, so G. G is some sort of a disk, let's say, and del G is its boundary circle, or it may not be exactly circular, right? So then the theorem says that if you integrate a vector field over the boundary, then you get the same as if you integrated the curl of the vector field over the entire surface. And in electrodynamics, this is very useful because the curl of vector fields, such as the electric and the magnetic field, is related to the Maxwell equations to the time dependence of the other field. Curl of the magnetic field is related via the Maxwell equations to the time dependence of the electric field and vice versa. So what we have here is the curl. That's the important part. Vector fields, we can see how we can interpret them as differential forms. But what does the curl, what role does the curl play? Now, it turns out that if omega is a vector field, what is really meant in the physics literature in this case is that omega is a one form. It's a one form. And then what is meant by the curl of that vector field, actually, mathematically speaking, differential geometrically speaking, it's just the exterior derivative of it. So that this is Stokes' theorem again. You have a region, and here you have d of w, and here you have w itself, and you have the boundary. So you either take the derivative here, or you take the derivative there. So you either take the boundary or the co-boundary, right? Since, just to spell this out again, here's Stokes' theorem. Remember, that's the boundary operator. And since its action can be replaced by doing the d operation on omega, right? So instead of taking the boundary, you could, because of Stokes' theorem, also take the exterior derivative of omega and not take the boundary. That's why this thing is called the co-boundary operator, because it plays sort of a dual role to the boundary operator, can replace it. Right, so the taking the curl is the co-boundary operator for this boundary operator here. Okay, and you could just plug in the various definitions and check that this actually reduces to Stokes' theorem. I mean, the fully general Stokes' theorem. Okay, now we're heading to another super important integration theorem, Gauss's theorem. Now, it turns out that Gauss's theorem cannot be proven from Stokes' theorem right away. There's something missing, and that's a volume form. Gauss's theorem needs also a volume form. Remember that for Stokes' theorem and all its applications so far, the term volume form didn't come up. We defined the volume form earlier. I give you some intuition, and I said that the existence of a volume form has to do with the orientability of the manifold. In fact, it means the orientability of the manifold. But we didn't actually use a volume form anywhere here. But for Gauss's theorem, we need that. And the reason is that Gauss's theorem is about what is called the divergence of a vector field. And you can view that in this way, that let's say you have air in a box. Now, that air can do two fundamentally different things. One is that it can swirl around. It can just rotate, change direction, move around. But the air can also expand or shrink. So you can have, for example, you can put some heat source somewhere, and then the air will actually expand outwards. It will move outwards, right? Which looks a little impossible if you think about it. Where does it come from? Well, it gets thinner, of course, as you do that, right? But it moves just outwards. Oh. We lost this again. Right. And you may remember that, well, if you took calculus with me, you would remember it. What is it again? 10, 30, 20, 191, right?
Yeah.
Yep. And 5101. Okay. Yes. And so if you remember from calculus in R3, vector fields can be decomposed into two components, the curl and the gradient, right? And in particular, you can calculate then the divergence from it. And the divergence is important because it tells you, you know, how much fresh velocity is being generated, right? I mean, you can just deflect the velocity. You have a curl. You have some movement around. Or you can also have that, you know, there is some fresh movement. So generally, what you have is that a vector field can be decomposed into something like that, where it's just some sort of swirl. But you can also have a situation like this. And then you can ask how much new volume, not volume really, but you know, how much is emerging there, right? Something that would be zero here because it's just shifting it around. Here though, you can change the density of stuff. And you can imagine that you can keep track of this without knowing about volume, just changing of directions. But here you need to know about volume. And that's what Gauss's theorem is about. And that's why the volume form comes in, because the volume form keeps track of density of stuff. OK, so Gauss's theorem. And for that, we need to define first the volume of a region. And for that, we need a volume form. So how would we calculate the volume of some region of a manifold in regular calculus on R3? Well, or Rn. So in Rn, we have that the volume of some region G is just integrating over that volume with the integrand being 1. That gives us the volume. For example, if you want to calculate the volume of a sphere, then you just integrate over a sphere, the integrand being 1. Now, in general, though, if we want to integrate to find out the volume on a manifold, of some region in a manifold, then we need to choose a volume form. The reason being that if we don't have some reference form to work with, then we can make everything appear big or small just by changing coordinates. So we need something coordinate independent that fixes what we mean by a volume. So in general, we need to choose a volume form, which is an N form, which obeys that it doesn't vanish anywhere in the region over which we want to integrate to obtain the volume. So once we have an N form, that's always positive, then we can define it as a reference to obtain the volume. It defines the volume on the manifold. Namely, the volume is simply defined as the integral over that volume form. Clearly, omega should never be negative, because otherwise we would end up with negative volumes. And I remind you that G is orientable if there exists a volume form. In fact, if there is a volume form, there are infinitely many volume forms, because you can take a volume form and multiply it with 7, it's still a volume form. All it needs to be is an N form that is always positive. Now, you may wonder, that's weird, because what we have now, at this point, with the volume form, is a differentiable manifold for which we can calculate volumes. Volumes of this piece, volumes of that piece, and so on, using this formula here. But we still can't calculate distances, right? Because we still haven't defined the notion of distance. And that's true. We have given the manifold some geometry now, but it's a very poor kind of geometry. We can only calculate volumes, nothing else. Later it will turn out that when we define distances using what is called the metric, then, of course, being able to calculate distances, we should be able to calculate volumes. And then we have to ask, well, is it going to be the same as that? In general, not. In general, not. Then we would end up with two different notions of volume. However, this is physics, not math. And so what we do is we say, well, there is only one notion of volume. And therefore, we will choose this volume as being what is induced by the metric. At this point, we can just choose whatever we want. But once we define the metric, the metric defines lengths, and therefore also volumes, and therefore the metric will induce a volume form. So we will revisit this later and find out what the volume form is that is induced by the metric. But there has been work in which people have considered the mathematical possibility that the volume form might not be the one induced by the metric, and so have that as a separate degree of freedom. I just wanted to mention that for completeness. People are pursuing this, but so far it hasn't given us anything exciting yet. Okay, so now, the next special case for the application of Stokes' theorem, which is Gauss's theorem. In order to obtain Gauss's theorem, we need to define yet a new derivative, as if we didn't have enough derivatives yet. And that's the divergence of a vector field. Right? It's quantifying how much of this is going on apart from that. Right? We neglect the rotations, how much of this is going on. On our end, the divergence of a vector field psi, and by vector field I mean a tangent vector field psi, is defined, if you remember, it's defined simply like that. You take the vector field and differentiate each component by the corresponding coordinate. dxi by dxi, dxi I by dxi, right? That's, oh my god. Right. So, So that's the usual definition of the divergence, as you may know it, for example, for the electric field. If you calculate the divergence of the electric field, you get a scalar quantity. Remember what that is? The charge. It's the charge density, right? And yes, that's what a charge does, right? It creates this. Creates electric field lines emerging from it. Okay, so how can we generalize that? This is just, you know, R3. Now, let's remember where we saw expressions like that before. We saw expressions like that, dxi by dxi. We saw those, because remember, that's what the comma means. It means differentiate with respect to xi. We saw that when we defined the Lie derivative. The Lie derivative of a tensor field in the direction of xi is given by this expression, where we have here the derivative of the xi I dj by dxi. So we get all of those terms here. There's only one term that messes things up a little bit, because this first term here is actually derivative of the tensor, and you just leave that vector alone. However, if we choose this tensor to be constant, if this was just, if this coefficient function tau was just 1, for example, then we would really have something that is very closely just a divergence. Especially if we only use covariant indices here. If this was a covariant tensor, then we get the plus signs, and we get only something that looks like the divergence. Now, you see, this thing itself would not be covariant. It wouldn't be, for a general differential manifold, this thing wouldn't transform properly, right? But the Lie derivative does. That's canonical. That's, you know, a coordinate system independent thing. That wouldn't be. So what we want is something coordinate system independent. So we have two pieces now that help us identify how to define a divergence on a differentiable manifold. One is the Lie derivative ought to have to do with it. And on the other hand, since the divergence is something sensitive to volume, it should have something to do with the volume form too, right? Because, you know, how much is being generated, that has to, is the question of, you know, what's the density of what generates that field? Like the charge density, as we said earlier, right? The divergence of the electric field gives us the charge density. But the density is always charge per volume. So the volume needs to somehow enter into this. And so what we do here is this. We choose the Lie derivative in order to define the divergence in general. We do use the Lie derivative of the vector field, I mean for the vector field. But what should we Lie differentiate? Well, what we can Lie differentiate here is the volume form. You see, in Rn, what would be the volume form? Just 1. Right? In Rn, the volume form is trivial. Like the density of volume, so to speak, is trivial in Rn, which means that this first term would actually be absent anyway, because d1 by whatever you differentiate by is a constant, so you get the derivative is vanishing. So you just get those derivative terms, which are exactly that. So the Lie in Rn, the Lie derivative in the xi direction of the constant volume form just gives us this formula back. But it's covariant. It's a thing that is canonically defined. And so we just define it for an arbitrary volume form now. If we choose omega to be 1 times dx1 which etc. dxn, then we just recover that for Rn. But in general, what we say is that the divergence of a vector field is given by the Lie derivative of the vector field in the xi direction. And all of that, that definition is relative to the choice of a volume form omega. And the volume form will later be the volume form that's induced by the metric which defines distances. Okay, so in practice, how does this play out? Let's say omega is a volume form, so it can for sure be written as a function times the canonical basis vector, there's only one, for n forms, d dx1 to dxn. And the a of x has to be positive because it's a volume form. And let's say that our vector field, whose divergence we want to calculate, has these coefficient functions. Then, by this definition, the divergence of the vector field with respect to this volume form is given by the Lie derivative of the volume form in the direction of the vector field psi. And now we can apply the Leibniz rule. We apply the Leibniz rule, which means we get a term where we apply the Lie derivative to the where we apply the Lie derivative to the first function, to the a of x. And then by the product rule, we get terms where we leave that the same and apply the Lie derivative to the basis vectors. So the first term is where we apply the Lie derivative to this function, but the Lie derivative, remember, it's a directional derivative, applied to functions, it's just the ordinary directional derivative. So the Lie derivative in the psi direction of a of x is just psi of a. It's just a literal directional derivative, this thing applied to that scalar function, that's that, carrying this one simply forward unchanged. And then, by the product rule, we leave that alone, and we differentiate each one of these guys in turn. So we leave that the same, we just carry that forward, the a of x, that positive scale factor. And then we have a sum where we differentiate either this one or that one, differentiate them one after the other. And in particular, we then have the Lie derivative of one of those basis vectors. And here is the detail of how that is all worked out. So we have the Lie derivative of the dxi. And remember, the Lie derivative of the exterior derivative is the exterior derivative of the Lie derivative. The Lie derivative of a function is the ordinary directional derivative of that function. So, and now I plug in what that is. The vector field is this. And now we have to evaluate d by dxj of xi. That's just the Kronecker delta. So we have the exterior derivative of xi j, Kronecker delta. And we sum that over. So we just get xi I. So we have the d of the xi I. And the d of the xi I is d xi I by dxr dxr. So putting all of this together, we obtain that the divergence of the vector field with respect to an underlying volume form is given by one term where we differentiate the a, the prefactor, and another term where we carry forward the prefactor, and we have all of those derivatives here of the vector field, the thing that we would normally, on Rn, associate with the divergence. You see, this term goes away on Rn when a is just 1 everywhere, then that term goes away. And here what we see is that we have xi I and the a differentiated, and here we have the a and the xi I differentiated. We can write this as a total derivative. We can write this as 1 over a and then the derivative of that times the volume form here. The volume form has an a, that's why we need a 1 over a here. And this alone is just that. So in particular, just to reiterate, if in Rn we choose the volume form to be just constantly 1, then this formula just gives us back that the divergence of a vector field in Rn with respect to the volume form that's always 1 is just the sum of the derivatives of the components of this tangent vector field. So the usual divergence there. And here we have the last slide. We can now finally derive Gauss's theorem from Stokes's theorem. And what do we have? We have that the divergence of the tangent vector field, the direction vector field psi, the divergence of the field whose divergence we want to know with respect to volume form omega is the Lie derivative of the volume form in the psi direction, which is an n form. And now, if you remember, the Lie derivative can be written using Cartan's formula in this way. Sorry, in this way. The Lie derivative is inner and then exterior derivative plus exterior and then inner derivation. right? That's an old formula that we had. Well, not that old, but last week. So we can write the Lie derivation in this way. And you see, we really switched gears because we used the Lie derivation explicitly in terms of coordinates earlier, just now, to identify that this is what we should do to get the divergence. But now we use the fact that there's a powerful formula to write the Lie derivation. And what we now see is that this term actually goes away because omega is an n form, it's a volume form, so it's an n form, which it has already the top degree. There are no n plus 1 forms on an n-dimensional differentiable manifold. But this formula asks us to take the exterior derivative of the volume form, which must vanish, right? Because you know the exterior derivative applied to a top form, the n form, always is 0. So that term goes away, and we can write the divergence simply as first inner derivation, then exterior derivation. The inner derivation is the easiest thing ever. You simply, remember, you take the n form and you plug the xi into the first port. And then you get an n minus 1 form. And you can take the exterior derivative of that, that's what you get there. That's an n form again, right? So the divergence is an n form. Let's keep that in mind. The divergence we think of as a number, like the charge density. But the charge density is actually not a scalar function. The charge density is actually an n form. OK, and now that we have the divergence in this form, we can apply Stokes' theorem because we have this exterior derivative here. So what we can do is this. Remember, here's Stokes' theorem again for a differential form nu, saying that you could do the boundary operator, or you could do the co-boundary operator, get the same result. What it says is this. Imagine you have a region in an n-dimensional manifold. So you want to integrate an n-form over that. Now, you obtain an n-form by taking an n form, namely the volume form, applying the inner derivation to it, and then the exterior derivation to it, that's an n form. So you're integrating this n form over an n-dimensional manifold. That formula checks out. That's an n form that we integrate over an n-dimensional manifold. And this is actually the divergence, right? Because this. So we have that the divergence integrated over an n form, the divergence being itself an n-form, integrated over an n-dimensional manifold. So the divergence being an n-form integrated over an n-dimensional manifold, or region of the manifold G, is the same as if we do not take the exterior derivative, but we just take the volume form, plug in the xi, that vector field, get an n minus 1 form, and integrate that over the boundary. So overall, this means that the divergence of a vector field with respect to a volume form is an n form, which when integrated over an n-dimensional region of a manifold, is the same, according to Gauss's theorem, which is really Stokes' theorem, as taking the volume form, plugging in the vector field as into the first entry, and then obtaining an n minus 1 form, which you then integrate over this n minus 1 dimensional boundary of G. That's Gauss's theorem. And then if you choose this all to take place in R3, for example, then you obtain the usual formulation of Gauss's theorem from that. OK, that was a lot of integration today. All right, good. Any questions?